Welcome. This is Book Reviews, and I'm your reader, Marcia. Today I'll be reading from the Journal Gazette, and I'll also be reading from the New York Times Book Reviews. And now I'm going to begin with the Journal Gazette, copyright 2026, and this is the date, the issue from June 27th, 2026, in the Book Reviews pages. This week's review is entitled At the Summit, Fort Wayne lands a starring role in writer's rambling Appleseed adventure. The book that is actually highlighted is entitled American Rambler, Walking the Trail of Johnny Appleseed, authored by Isaac Fitzgerald, 352 pages. If you're going to retrace the steps of John Chapman, you're going to end up in Fort Wayne. Isaac Fitzgerald did, he does, and we can all be grateful for this outsider's take on the Summit City. American Rambler is Fitzgerald's recounting of a year spent examining the continuing pull of the Johnny Appleseed legend, and in the best literary journalism tradition, the journey is a jumping-off point for Fitzgerald's musings on his life as well as on our communal one. And while Fitzgerald's thoughts are not always happy or reassuring, you don't have to be pleased if you're a Fort Wayne reader. We come off looking awfully good. On his penultimate page, Fitzgerald summarizes his findings by writing, "The country that we live in can break you if you look directly at it, but also consume you if you ignore the truth of it, choosing instead only the legend." A bit of a downer, perhaps, but as they say of any journey, getting there is half the fun. So we find ourselves initially west of Boston, in the Massachusetts birthplace of Chapman and Fitzgerald, roughly two centuries apart. The narrative is arranged by season. We begin in spring, although the snowy, muddy, still kind of winter part of spring. After a two-paragraph recounting of the life legend of Chapman Appleseed, Fitzgerald offers his motivation. Like any child who hears that they have a tenuous, at best, connection to somebody famous, I became obsessed with both the man and the myth. As someone who shares a February 11th birthday with fellow Northern Ohio native Thomas Edison, I could immediately relate to this youthful interest. Walking was a favorite pastime of the less-than-affluent family of Fitzgerald's youth, so Isaac comes by it naturally. When he tells his parents of his vision, he receives more than just advice. "My father hands me a pair of tough-looking, well-broken-in leather hiking boots. Walking in my father's shoes felt a little on the nose, but then again it would beat the blisters my Timberlands would give me." The boots, which offer a counterpoint to the stereotypical image of a barefoot Chapman, adorn the cover of American Rambler. But as a distinctly 20th-century form of rambling takes center stage for much of the trip, as Fitzgerald soon invests in a jeep he christens Rabbit, which carries him to numerous Chapman-related stops across Pennsylvania and through Ohio. Fitzgerald's route on to Fort Wayne first takes a southerly detour for a visit with an old friend in Indianapolis, Ashley C. Ford. Ford's much-heralded 2021 memoir, Somebody's Daughter, is her story of growing up in southeast Fort Wayne. 30 chapters into his own book, Fitzgerald arrives in a gorgeous new city to explore, and he wastes no time. As in many of the other places he has stopped already, Fitzgerald gravitates toward a bar. He eventually lands not 100 yards from where I sit as I write this, after an acquaintance tells him, "Henry's is your kind of place, Isaac." She was right. The restaurant has small but welcoming booths, and the bar is old wood and hazy glass. The room is packed with a thrumming weekend crowd, so much so, in fact, that we decide to sit outside. For anyone wanting to experience the Fort Wayne Appleseed Nexus, a Tin Caps game is a must. Fitzgerald nods early to that fact that the cooking pot on the head trope is at best disputed. He happens to attend the Star Wars night. Fitzgerald arrives at Parkview Field early for a stadium tour with the team's Michael Lemmer. Their discussion covers Philo Farnsworth and Sylvia Bowser as readily as it does Johnny Tin Cap and Wayne the Wizard. Not gonna lie, was not expecting this many inventors hailing from Indiana, second largest city. Come the fall of American Rambler, Fitzgerald makes an obligatory return for what becomes a literal religious experience. The Johnny Appleseed Festival is huge beyond my wildest imagination. Like some sort of a frontier-themed Coachella, The Sunday morning of the September Festival weekend offers a service in the denomination, Swedenborgen, for which Chapman frequently proselytized during his walks. By the end, filled with appreciation for nature and John Chapman, and the spiritual experience of sitting outside with strangers from all different backgrounds and walks of life, listening to a preacher whose religion very few or none of us subscribe to, but sensing the truth of the words of a need to commune with the world, well, I am moved to tears. It is an abundant feeling that I have not felt in some time, perhaps not since going to Mass as a child. That emotion helps sustain Fitzgerald through the downcast winter that concludes American Rambler. His year of rumination leaves him with profound thoughts about the land he has just experienced so intimately and intensely, what it is and what it might be. America itself is a memorial to ideas, a rose-colored view on history, not to mention human civility, a yearning for people to be the best, most democratic versions of themselves, for us to view each other as equals, dreams and ideals that we as a people and as a country fall short on time and time again. Again, this particular book that is focused is entitled American Rambler, Walking the Trail of Johnny Appleseed by Isaac Fitzgerald. Moving on now to new library books. The ones I'm going to highlight next, all six of them, are works of revolutionary history and are newly available at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The first book is entitled The Lost Founder, James Wilson and the Forgotten Fight for a People's Constitution by Jesse Wegman. Wegman chronicles the life of a brilliant early patriot who drafted the first version of the Constitution and championed a strong central government, only to have his lasting legacy overshadowed by a tragic downfall. That book is entitled The Lost Founder, James Wilson and the Forgotten Fight for a People's Constitution, authored by Jesse Wegman. The next book is entitled Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence by Robert G. Parkinson. Shifting focus away from the preamble's idealized philosophy to explore the 27 grievances against King George, Parkinson reveals how immediate wartime anxieties and specific British provocations drove the colonies to break with the crown. That book, again, is entitled Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence by Robert G. Parkinson. Our next book, American Patriarch, The Life of George Washington, authored by H. W. Brands. The author tracks how a resourceful young officer morphed into a leader of immense authority and modesty, ultimately securing early Republican ideals by twice relinquishing supreme power. Book again is entitled American Patriarch, The Life of George Washington, authored by H. W. Brands. Our next book is entitled Freedom Round the Globe, A World History of the American Revolution, authored by Sarah M. S. Pearsall. Tracing the impact of key words from the Declaration of Independence across far-flung locales such as India, West Africa, and rural Germany, Pearsall reveals how global struggles actively shaped the nature of the American Revolution. Again, that book is entitled Freedom Round the Globe, A World History of the American Revolution by Sarah M. S. Pearsall. Our next book, National Treasure, How the Declaration of Independence Made America, authored by Michael Ostlin. Ostlin charts the physical journey and profound cultural afterlife of the United States founding parchment, following it from a Philadelphia boarding house through various wartime concealments to its modern preservation as an evolving national symbol. Again, that book is entitled National Treasure, How the Declaration of Independence Made America by Michael Ostlin. And our last book is entitled The Unfinished Business of 1776, Why the American Revolution Never Ended by Thomas Richards. The Constitution is framed as an ongoing mission statement rather than a static historical event, as Richards explores how generations of outsiders and reformers have fought to realize the unfulfilled promises of liberty and justice. Again, that book is entitled The Unfinished Business of 1776, Why the American Revolution Never Ended, authored by Thomas Richards. And now I'm reading from the New York Times Book Reviews, NewYorkTimes.com, copyright 2026, The New York Times Company. And we're going to begin our reviews today with mystery books. The very first one is entitled Heather, a novel by Caitlin Mullen. Halfway through 2026, I found my favorite crime novel of the year. So far, one that I'm already recommending to people who love Tana French and Liz Moore. Saying this about Heather is a great relief because I've been anticipating this novel ever since Mullen's Edgar-winning debut, Please See Us, bowled me over in 2020. Like that earlier book, Heather is set in New Jersey. After years as a narcotics detective, 30-year-old Callie Hauser has returned home to a small town in the Pines Barrows as its police chief, and the first person she arrests is her own mother. After the show-stopping opening scene, Mullen unspools a narrative of corkscrew complexity involving decades-old unearthed remains, even older family secrets, and the ways in which young women are preyed upon. Callie wonders whether there will ever be a day when girls aren't told how to look, won't be forced to contort themselves into one thing only for the fad to pass, and then they are handed the next template. Mullen depicts Callie's story with a combination of gimlet-eyed compassion and ice-cold rage. I read Heather in a single setting, equal parts infuriated and dazzled. Again, that particular mystery is entitled Heather, and it's authored by Caitlin Mullen. Our next book, again another mystery, is entitled Blunt Instrument, authored by Amy Bloom. So many writers of literary fiction have pivoted to crime writing with varying results that I have become blasé to the point of cynicism. But Blunt Instrument, The Mysterious Press, 288 pages, the first in a new mystery series by Bloom, startled me in the very best possible way. Its wry tone is in keeping with her prior literary work, and Bloom engages with the full spectrum of genre expectations. Del Chandler was supposed to be an academic, but a life of the mind did not end up working out, so she became a private detective. She's back on the Cromwell University campus to investigate the murder of the oafish professor, Oliver Bulfinch, done in by a bronze bust of Nathaniel Hawthorne. It's a setup worthy of Helen Estes's The Horizontal Man or any of Amantha Cross's mysteries. Bloom takes clear pleasure in exploring Dell's complicated feelings about academia, how it's tied to her relationship with her father, and how reckoning with his past and this past while investigating a grisly killing is bound to throw serious emotional curveballs. This is rich terrain, and I am eager for Bloom to delve deeper in future installments. And again, that particular book is entitled Blunt Instrument, authored by Amy Bloom. Our next mystery, A Murder in Springtime, by Martin Walker. Walker's charming Bruno, chief of police books, are solid procedurals, but their true pleasures are found in the depictions of the small Dorgon town of St. Denis and the idiosyncratic characters who populate this place. A Murder in Springtime is 228 pages, and its 19th installment. And it's the perfect place to start if you are new to the series or, like me, had not checked in for some years. Bruno is feeling a little harried. His current relationship is teetering. A film crew has taken over St. Denis, and he is spending a great deal of time trying to save the town's struggling market. The market is our heart, he tells a friend. Without the market, how long would the café stay open? The Maison de la Presse, the Boulanger's. Our market is our magnet, and we cannot afford to lose it. So it's all too easy for him to ignore calls from his neighbor and good friend Pamela. Wrong move. She discovered her brand new lodger murdered on the patio. She could not have done it, though Bruno feels he cannot investigate since he and Pamela have known each other for so very long. But then his rookie detective, Fabian, realizes he's even more connected to the victim, putting Bruno back on the case. Walker sneaks in surprising twists under cover of a slow-burn, community-driven mystery in a very magical setting. And again, that book is entitled A Murder in Springtime, authored by Martin Walker. Moving on, our next mystery, entitled Sex on Murder Island by Joe Firestone. Finally, I'm not sure how I missed Firestone's Murder on Sex Island when it came out in 2023. I have rectified that. It is a delightful, side-splitting satire of the reality TV industry as seen from the perspective of Luella Van Horn, the crime-solving alter ego of a Staten Island social worker named Marie Jones. The sequel, Sex on Murder Island, 233 pages, brings Luella back in a few months after her first sleuthing triumph. Somehow, she's even worse off than before. The gigs are scant, her money is almost gone, she's about to be evicted, and oh yeah, she's turning 30. Of course, she will accept a new case that takes her to Murder Island, an exclusive enclave near New York City, where she's hired to investigate an extramarital affair that, alas, has led to murder. As Luella investigates, she grows increasingly taken aback at the island's naughty activities. Let's just say I've never read a more wholesome novel involving multiple sex parties. She'll catch the killer, but the book shines brightest in its depiction of a lonely woman searching for real friends. And again, that particular book is entitled Sex on Murder Island, authored by Joe Firestone. Moving on now to a memoir. After 40 years, a tenacious lifeguard still swims against the tide. Janet Fash was always outspoken when it came to keeping beachgoers safe. She lays it all out in her feisty new memoir. If you've ever walked the halls of a big school with a well-respected principal, you know what it's like to stroll a stretch of Rockaway Beach with Janet Fash. "How's everything?" she called to almost every lifeguard. "How you doing? How's the chair? Good?" One guard waved to Fash, who worked on this 7-mile stretch of Queens shoreline for 40 years. Another guard gave a little salute. A third, sporting mirrored sunglasses and orange trunks, jogged up behind us. "Janet, I had to come say hi. Hello." They chatted about the water, like an ice bath, about the seafood in Portugal, where Fash just completed a 62-mile spiritual walk with her sister, and about Fash's memoir, Lifeguard, a love story which comes out June 23rd. And she invited him to her book party at the Bell Harbor Yacht Club, and he said he would try it on. "Lifeguards are really one big community," Fash said as we walked away, and then something caught her eye. "Hold up a sec." She doubled back, approaching a lifeguard who was scrolling on his phone. "Hi there. Excuse me. You should be looking up, not down." Chastened, the young man lifted his eyes to the ocean. Fash, 66, started lifeguarding when she was in college. Even as a rookie, she defied the stereotype of the lackadaisical teen, idly twirling a whistle until something better came along. For Fash, the job was calling, an escape from workday work at a Wall Street brokerage firm, and then during summers off from her teaching job. She met her husband of 36 years on the beach at 106th Street, carried out rescues while pregnant, taught her two children to respect these waves. In 1988, Fash was named New York City's first female chief lifeguard. She became a vocal critic of political maneuvering and corner cutting that she still believes compromise the safety of swimmers. "The city of New York is really not running it the way they should," Fash said, referring to the 1,000 or so seasonal lifeguards employed by the Department of Parks and Recreation. They could do a better job. Her proud and forthright memoir grew out of a story about her for Curbed, which is part of the New York Magazine. "Most of the lifeguards I worked with wanted to be heroes," Fash writes. "The police called themselves New York's finest, the firemen were New York's bravest, and the sanitation workers were New York's strongest. We called ourselves New York's wettest. It was a joke, but we did see ourselves as one of the city's core public servants, even if the rest of the city did not always see us that way." Bert Kiss, who reported to Fash in the 1980s, said, "Janet would always remind us that people's lives were in our hands. She took that very seriously." Before we even set foot on the sand, Fash assessed the ocean from the boardwalk, scanning it like a reader facing a bookshelf. "There's a north wind," she pronounced. "This is a beautiful day." Still, she cautioned, "See the foam over there? That's a lateral current. When the tide is pulling out, it can be problematic. I know from experience, working here all of those years." Fash grew up in Park Slope, Brooklyn, one of seven children. When she was 10, her parents rented a bungalow on 93rd Street in Rockaway at the recommendation of one of her father's co-workers at Con Ed. "We arrived, and it was wonderful," Fash said. "You walked down and jumped in the water." Recounting this era in her book, Fash includes notes of mischief and nostalgia. In person, she has just the facts delivery of the middle and the high school teacher that she once was. When I asked her to describe the beach in midsummer, she said, "Wall-to-wall people, blanket-to-blanket, and music." When I asked her to recall her first drowning, she said, "He was a teenage boy. He went out so fast, it was devastating." When I asked her advice on floundering swimmers, she said, "Float on your back, relax, don't panic." Fash is, of course, fluent in lifeguard lingo. A horn is a first-year guard, subject to hazing, which in Fash's day ranged from cruel to humiliating to criminal. One of her friends was forcibly stripped of her bathing suit. Another was hospitalized after being slathered with toxic paint. A bathtub case involves a rescue before a swimmer is actually in trouble, and DFD refers to a person who is down for the day. Rockaway's most damning epitaph has thankfully been lost to the sands of time. "When someone drowned on your watch," Fash said, "you were called a murderer. The price you had to pay was to buy a keg and throw a party that night," she writes. "It was a mock wake, where sometimes they would even bury the keg in sand like it was a grave." As we sat on the jetty near where she made her first save, Fash described the weight of the job, which is a major theme in her memoir. She spoke of teenagers crying for a drowned friend, parents on the boardwalk waiting for the child's body to be found. "We almost want to be invisible," Fash said. "We don't want them to come to us because we feel we didn't get our job done." Over the years, Fash has lobbied for better equipment for guards, including fins, binoculars, walkie-talkies, and jet skis, swimming lessons for neighborhood children, mandatory ocean drills, not just pool swims, for guards in training, a lifeguard manual to be shared among all waterfront staff, and a separation of union leadership and management roles to ensure fair promotions. "I hit my head against the wall so many times," Fash said. "It taught me a lot about writing letters and keeping people accountable." When she launched a lifeguard development program with the Department of Education, Fash said she was penalized by the Parks Department. "They made the public and me suffer by giving me less lifeguards," Fash explained. She was assigned staff who didn't know Rockaway Beach, which tends to be busier than nearby Bell Harbor, an affluent neighborhood where she said most residents know how to swim. "It's like any other job. If you're used to a slow area and you're thrown into a busy area," Fash said, "my boss would be like, 'They're all trained the same.' No, they are not." She gestured at the wide beach flanked by tall apartment buildings. "This is where the public comes to visit." Parks officials declined to comment on her claims. In 2024, Cleo Chang interviewed Fash for CureBed. Not long after that story came out, Sean Manning, now the publisher of Simon & Schuster, reached out to see if Fash might be interested in writing a book. At first, she was apprehensive. "I said, I got to think about this. I wasn't sure how much of a commitment it was." She was enjoying retirement, yoga, pickleball, visits to her condo in Rincon, PR, where she swims with other retired lifeguards. Eventually, Fash came around to the idea. She met with Chang, her co-author, for a series of interviews in Queens and in Rincon. They talked about Fash's family, her rugby days, her refusal to take guff from her male supervisors, her evolution into an activist, and they took breaks for pickleball and surfing. This was the first book writing experience anyone could ever have, and also the best book writing experience. Fash cried when she read the first draft. She cried again when recording the audiobook, which showcases both her determination and her Brooklyn accent. Describing her many tangles with the Parks Department, Fash's voice vibrates with pride. "I don't have balls at all," she reads. "I've got iron ovaries." Manning, a college rower who still occasionally body surfs, said, "People don't often see lifeguarding as a strenuous, important job it is. Janet makes it clear how difficult this work is, both physically and emotionally. Difficult and sometimes gritty. We see Fash chasing down a guy who robbed a hot dog vendor, co-workers doing cocaine in their shack, and a band of lifeguards known as the Justice League, investigating the longtime union boss who is the villain of the story." Ambling off the sand, Fash greeted a boardwalk barista by name, then a former neighbor who runs the Rockaway Film Festival. "We headed to Connolly's, a wood paneled watering hole that used to be owned by the grandfather of one of Fascia's lifeguards. It was early afternoon, but there were already a few diehards bellying up to the bar. "Oh, my God, all the pina coladas," Fascia said, reminiscing about her youth, and she pointed to the wall of photos from bikini contests to a picture of her friend Steve Belson, a veteran lifeguard and firefighter who died on 9-1-1. On another wall, just inside the front door, were a few vintage lifeguard shots. In one, taken around 1985, Fascia's holding a hot dog in one hand, a beverage in the other, and her whistle dangles from her wrist. She is clearly in her element. These days, Fascia feels the physical toll of all those years on the beach. She has bursitis from hauling people out of the water. Her knees are not what they used to be. In 2018, she was treated for melanoma. Still, Fascia writes, "I feel ageless in the water." And she continues to put in her 2 cents with the lifeguards. "Keep them alive," she says, like a mantra. "Watch the water and keep them alive." And that particular book that we've just highlighted is entitled Lifeguard, A Love Story. And again, the author is Janet Fascia. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. This has been Marcia with Book Reviews.